And good morning. 10 minutes now before 9 o'clock on this Thursday morning. And joining me, WGBH Arts Editor Jared Bowen. Good morning, Jared.
Good morning, Bob.
Well, lots to talk about this morning. Quite a diverse array of productions, starting with something called Colossal, being presented by Company One at the Boston Center for the Arts.
Yes, football that has nothing to do with scandal or
deflating
the inflation. Yeah, exactly. None of that. Football coming to Boston without those things is happening right now. And this is really a terrific production. It's called, as you mentioned, Colossal, and it's presented by Company One Theater at the Boston Center for the Arts through August 15th. This is a piece. Let me just set the scene for you. First of all, let me set the pre-scene for you. You should go early because you come upon AstroTurf inside the theater, two banks of seats on either side, the countdown clock staring at you, and the football players who are actors and dancers are all warming up, doing their warming up exercises. You feel like you're walking into a game. And what happens in the very first few moments is you see this beautiful football play, and you see this character Mike, played by Alex Molina, who is a football player was in his college career. It has this terrific play, and suddenly there's something that just goes horrifically awry, and you see Mike's future self, played by a separate actor, Marlon Shepard, who's making his theatrical debut. He is also wheelchair bound, as the script requires. Comes in and begins to take stock of that game, that moment, and what has just happened to him. And you see him reconciling where he is now in this wheelchair with this young, virile, athletic, filled with athletic prowess person that he was. And from there, we go through this piece, which looks at the notions of football today, what it means to be super athletic and powerful and young and fearlessly forceful, and what it means to be gay in the sport, because it's such a hyper-masculine sport. So what happens in the locker room, and he's dealing with this emerging homosexuality as he has this attraction for his team co-captain. These are all elements that come to the fore in a piece that's played in four quarters with a halftime. There is a drum line at halftime with Berkeley students. But I talked recently to their director, Summer Williams, who just beautifully directs this piece, I have to say, about why football works here in this theater space.
These are titans, right? There are like marchers going out to war. They're like our guys who are out there playing hard, and they're the villains that we create and the heroes that we create, and that can change. It's the theater that happens in the world most consistently, even though we don't call it theater.
And which is fascinating, given, as we were sort of joking before, but the life that football has taken on since this playwright, Andrew Hinderaker, began writing this a few years ago, because you've had your first openly gay player emerge on the scene. You've had the conversations about concussions and domestic abuse. And now, of course, Tom Brady and what has happened, how that's blown up into this national story. So this playwright was really anticipating a lot of this, as you see it in this little microcosm level of these young players. But I also spoke to actor Alex Molina, just graduated from Harvard, who plays young Mike, and as I mentioned earlier, who played football throughout his college career, about how that comes to bear here.
The first thing we do at a rehearsal is the fight call, where we put on the pads, put on the helmets, and we practice the hitting that we do, which is pretty much live tackling. So there's this amount of, like, remembering the dread of that. And then also right when it's done, I'm like, all right, yeah, like, oh my God, that was great. Why am I not playing football still?
So there is a lot of authenticity. And I will tell you, Bob, this has one heck of an ending, a very powerful, dramatic ending.
All right. Not an overtime ending, though.
No. Okay.
Colossal, being presented by Company One at the Boston Center for the Arts through August 15th. Next, an American icon, Lafayette. And I won't really try to pronounce his whole name, of which there are about 10 parts. We'll just say Lafayette.
You disappoint me, Bob. I was looking forward to you doing that. Because
Except
I'm
the first
certainly
of them is Marie, so yes. I don't know where to go from there.
Well, I'm certainly not going to do it either. But Lafayette, an American icon, is on view right now at the Boston Athenaeum through September 27th. And you might remember, just about in the middle of last month, the Hermione, a French ship, a recreation of a French ship that brought Lafayette over here, made a stop in Boston.
Right. Yeah.
And this is in celebration of Lafayette's legacy here, where he was this young French aristocrat when he was just just about 19, 20 years old when he came to America, leaving behind this very affluent life because he was very inspired by the American Revolution, inserted himself into that revolution so that he became, as was later described, a citizen of both worlds, because he was a very instrumental figure in the American cause. But this exhibition looks at how we looked at Lafayette with great portraits. Charles Wilson Peale, who once painted Washington, did a very similar Washingtonian portrait of Lafayette, also very Napoleonic, very regal, because Lafayette did have a great relationship with George Washington, who considered him a son. We see face masks, sculpture. In fact, this whole exhibition started with a piece that Thomas Jefferson had in Monticello, a bust of Lafayette that his heirs sold off after Jefferson died. The Boston Athenaeum acquired it, so it's always been in their collection. And so I spoke recently with their director, the Boston Athenaeum's director, Elizabeth Barker, on Lafayette, who had the right personality to become this major part of the revolution.
At a moment when other French would-be participants in the conflict wanted to tell George Washington what to do, he said, with great apparent sincerity, that he wanted to learn how he could be helpful. And that was exactly the right approach. He would eventually become one of Washington's most invaluable collaborators on the war.
So in addition to seeing all of these different takes on Lafayette, who had this major celebrity, by the way, long after the revolution, when he was one of the last remaining figures of the revolution, coming back to the United States from France, he toured all 26 states in the Union, major celebrity. In fact, they have some of those pieces that were produced with his likeness, sort of the souvenirs and kitsch. But he had this one moment where he went to Mount Vernon to visit George Washington's grave, and he was given a cypress twig from nearby in the grave. That is in the exhibition. But he was so moved to tears by seeing this father figure, no longer, of course, visiting the grave, he could not speak because he was so tearful. And he wrote what he wrote down his thoughts, and you can see those in his own handwriting, those thoughts in the Athenaeum exhibit as well.
Okay, that's very interesting. At the Athenaeum, Lafayette, an American icon. Now, quickly, the Museum of Russian Icons. What are Russian icons?
Russian icons are basically used by Orthodox Christians as a tool for prayer. And they are saintly figures that convey the highest order of heroism, sacrifice, saintliness. And these are depictions and pictures that have been created throughout history. And the Museum of Russian Icons, there's a great story behind the story here. Gordon Langton is its founder. He's a plastics magnate and spent a lot of time in Russia. And in 1990, he found a Russian icon in a flea market. And he loves to collect, so he began collecting over and over. Yes, that's exactly what his wife said. She finally said, after there were about 100 Russian icons in their home, you can't have these in the house anymore. So he created a museum out of his own money. It's a beautiful museum. And now what you see is this collection of about 1,000 icons from the 1300s to present day, the largest collection of Russian icons outside of Russia. And they're gorgeous pieces, Bob, because largely in the way they're supposed to be created on wood with egg tempera paint, lots of symbolism, all of these different renderings which
and
have
this
a similar.
Is in Clinton, Massachusetts.
In Clinton, Massachusetts.
Amazing. Okay. And if you'd like to hear more about this and other great art stories, tomorrow night, Open Studio on WGBH2 at 8:30 features Jared Bowen, and who joins us every Thursday morning right here on Morning Edition. Thank you, Jared.
Thanks, Bob.